Good morning, Council. The next case on our calendar is Wayne, could you pronounce the last name for me?
Hukreed.
Hukreed versus Melanie Angliska. We're ready for oral arguments. Would each attorney be sure to state his or her name for the record before beginning each leg of your argument? And you are welcome to use either the microphone immediately adjacent to council table or the center microphone, which does raise and lower to your comfort.
Thank you. My name is Paul Sortland. I represent the appellants and the underlying plaintiffs, Wayne and Helen Hukreed, husband and wife, their son Stephen Hukreed, and his husband John Tripp. We brought this lawsuit against Ms. Liska and her law firm because of some unnecessary legal work that she did in drafting deeds in 2018 and 2019, which eliminated the Golden Life Estate that the parents had kept in this property since 1988. That's when a previous attorney working on this file helped them grant the deed to the son, Stephen Hukreed, keeping for themselves a life estate so they could live in that house until they died.
Can I just clarify, if I misheard you, I thought you said unnecessary legal work, but in fact, didn't your clients, the individual, Stephen and John, ask for assistance in getting the house put in joint tenancy? And
right.
So I know that ties into the issue of not representing parents' point, but that so it was necessary to, in order to get the joint tenancy. There might be other estate planning options, but that's what they had asked for, correct? In other words,
that's what they asked for, but they also warned her that his mother was elderly and may go into a nursing home.
Got to be careful there. She's only 72.
Yeah.
All right. But that's something he should watch out for, she should have watched out for, according to our expert witness. Moreover, it was unnecessary. You didn't have to give up the life estate reserved by the parents in order to put the house into joint tenancy for Stephen Hukreed and John Tripp. All they had to do was place the house in joint tenancy. Then they would have had the house in joint tenancy together, and the parents still would have had that life estate. Had Ms. Liska understood this, and had she explained it to them, a reasonable person would not have undergone the shenanigans that she suggested to them here. By harming them, most of the harm will fall upon, if not all the harm, will fall upon Stephen Hukreed, who would have received that house free and clear. But because of these transactions that occurred in 1999, the house will be subject to the medical assistance statutes. And at the time of the motion for summary judgment, that lien already exceeded, I believe it was $160,000, and it was going up at a rate of $10,000 per month.
Counsel, let me stop you. First of all, has a lien been filed?
No, lien can't be filed.
I want to explore the issue of damages, because mm-hmm. It seems there's a lot here, and the one area where I'm having trouble with the issue of whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact has to do with damages. So do I understand your argument to be your client had the benefit of the Golden Life Estate, no risk of attachment of an MA lien?
Correct.
That was lost when, as a result of the transactions which the attorney undertook.
Correct.
Creating the possibility that the property would become subject to a medical assistance lien. However, there has been no lien. If a lien is attached, it would be in the amount of the life estate of mother, and that amount would be determined based on her age, conditions, et cetera. So it seems to me there's a lot of speculation in terms of what the damages would be if this case went to trial now. It also seems to me that, you know, the one thing that is certain, and I'll ask opposition about this, is, well, there is, the one thing that's certain is you've lost the benefit of having no risk of a medical assistance lien, and now there is a risk of such a lien. Is that not accurate?
There's no risk of a lien. There's a certainty of a lien being filed when she dies.
Okay. So why not bring the lawsuit when she dies, when you can ascertain what the damages are, because at that point you have the lien?
Well, number one, the statute of limitations would have run. Number two, it's not.
Well, okay, let's stop there, because I understand, I think, what you're saying there, because I've looked at the cases having to do with accrual of a cause of action when damages are the issue. And Minnesota follows the rule that the statute of limitations begins to run when there are some actual damages. So is it your position that losing the benefit of the Golden Life estate is an actual damage that triggers running of the statute of limitations?
Well, I think in Anton versus Mervis, the statute of limitations ran for a defective antenuptial agreement at the time they paid the fees. Even though the damages from the faulty antenuptial agreement didn't occur till long later. And so it could go as early as when they paid the fees to Ms. Liska for her negligent advice.
Okay, so if we've got a situation then where the cause of action has accrued, there's enough damage to say the statute of limitation is running, then the issue seems to be, well, do you have adequate proof of damages that are not speculative, given that there is no lien, we don't know when there will be a lien, we don't know what the value of the lien will be because it's based on a life estate and mother's conditions at that time, and there are also some other statutes, and I'm no expert by any means, and this, these statutes are very dense, but reading through, I see, well, exceptions to a lien if the spouse is still residing in the property, and that seems to be the case here, so it just seems to me there are, how is a jury going to determine what the damages are prior to attachment of a lien? And what evidence would you offer that isn't speculative?
Well, it wouldn't be any more difficult than figuring out the life expectancy of somebody who was badly injured in a car accident.
I understand that argument, but here, to me, I think this is a difference, and you tell me if I'm wrong. It would be no different if the lien had attached. But to say what is mother's life expectancy here at the time of trial seems to be irrelevant if the lien is based on the value of the life estate. I mean, doesn't the value of the life estate change as she ages? Or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, the way my expert explained it to me is basically that lien extends to the amount paid to by medical assistance for her care in the nursing home. And like I say, at the time we did the motion papers, that was already $160,000.
Okay, then I'm not understanding this because I see in the briefing reference to, well, the value of the lien is based on the value of her life estate. What you seem to be saying is the lien is whatever has been paid, period.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between the experts on how that is valued. I know their expert might have argued something similar to that. My expert does not.
And, well, I mean, here's the thing. If she has a life estate, that life estate has certain value, and its worth, you know, its worth is dependent on how long she's going to live, because that, I would assume, factors into what's the extent of her life estate. And so if the county has, if there are MA expenses greater than that, well, so what? It would seem that they could only file a lien to the extent of her value, right? I mean, if I own a portion of a property and I own, you know, a percentage of a property and we look at the market value and it turns out, well, my percentage is worth $50,000 and someone to whom I owe $100,000 files a lien, I mean, they can't take $100,000 of the property when my interest in the property is only $50,000, right? So I'm kind of thinking of that and then thinking, well, is that how this life estate works? A life estate has a certain value, and the lien could take all of that value, but that value can change as she ages.
Well, There's a dispute among the experts there on that. My expert explained it more simply, basically stating the medical assistance lien for the amount already expended flies with the property, and that will be a detriment on Wayne Hukreid or Stephen Hukreid when she passes. The only issue is how long is she going to have those, is she going to incur medical assistance? And if that does, if the value of the lien does go down, I don't think it goes down to zero, but you can extrapolate how long you think she's going to live, as a jury would do in any personal injury case, and determine what the value of the lien would be at that time. My expert says that the lien would be imposed at the time of her death. They can't file it before the time of her death. They have to do it at the time of her death or within a year after her death. And that's the amount that has to be paid.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Trying to understand the trial court's reasoning and your response to it. So and first of all, let me tell you, I think that Wayne and Helen are in a different position than Steve and John. And
sure.
You would agree with that? Okay, so the trial court concluded that the Hukreids could not prove causation because Liska's actions in removing the life estate did not cause harm. So once the life estate was gone, then you couldn't put a lien on the homestead, right?
I totally disagree with that.
Okay.
They can put a lien on the homestead if she grants it for less than full consideration anytime after 2003.
Gotcha.
And that's exactly what Ms. Liska did. She didn't understand the medical assistance statutes. She didn't follow them. She didn't explain them to the clients, and she didn't explain them to Wayne or Helen Hukreid.
So it seems, though, that the district court then said that it was only because Steve and John later gave Helen and Wayne a life estate drafted by another lawyer that somehow broke the
And that doesn't, as I explained in my brief, that doesn't satisfy the superseding cause action. The harm was already done by Liska. This was just a Hail Mary pass by the subsequent attorney trying to save the house that should have been saved for Stephen Hukreid. And as we've analyzed it, it doesn't make a bit of difference one way or the other. It didn't make it more liable to the lien, didn't make it less liable to the lien. It is really a nonentity as far as our analysis here is concerned.
And I just want to back up because, again, I appreciate your explanations and following up on Judge Riley's question. So she's now in the nursing home. They eliminate her life estate. And at that point, you're saying a lien could be filed even though she has no interest in the property at that point?
They could have. Keep in mind, she was in the nursing home before the life, I'm sure she had a life estate eliminated, then went into the nursing home.
Okay, so she went into the life, all right. The life estate's eliminated, she goes into the nursing home. So at that point, well, what's her interest in the property at that point? Because the life estate's been eliminated. So, or would it fall under, well, within the look-back period,
right,
you had an interest.
Right.
So you're still on the hook.
She's still on the hook.
Okay,
yeah.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Any transaction that happened after August 1, 2003 is subject to those provisions of the medical assistance statutes. And like I say, Ms. Liska just didn't understand those.
Okay, so by eliminating her life, she doesn't avoid the lien by eliminating the life estate,
right,
because she did that within the look-back period.
Correct.
Got it.
And then respondents seem to argue that, so MA could put the lien on for 10 years and then renew it for 10 years. And so if Steve and John didn't sell the property for 20 years, there'd be no harm.
That's the way I read it, that you can renew it once for up to 20 years total. But, you know, to say that that eliminates any harm is hypothetical at best, or speculative at best. And frankly, it reads like it's a judgment renewal statute, you know, which can be renewed repetitively, but I've never seen one renewed beyond the initial or beyond the subsequent 10 years. He's going to die or he's going to convey the property. It's going to By a fair certainty, he's going to suffer the subject of that. And regardless of that, by doing these transactions the way she did, she got rid of the step-up basis provision in the tax code. And so Stephen Hootkrete would be subject to the step-up provision there because he would have inherited the parents' basis in the house. It's practically nothing. But for these transactions that Ms. Liska engaged in.
Of course, they argue that the house isn't worth $500,000, so he would not have to pay taxes anyway.
It's worth about $500,000 now, but before too long, it'll be more than that. And I thought the cutoff for taxes on homesteads was much lower than that, particularly if it's, you know, they've changed residences here a couple of times, and
well, they've been in there, I think it's 2 years, married couple, $500,000.
Well, for them, but not for Stephen. Well, anyway, I see my time's up, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and you'll have time on rebuttal.
All right,
we'll visit again.
Good morning.
Do you need to lower that?
I think
just a tad.
It's not too bad.
It's not too bad, but it is right in your face.
All right, I'll defer to you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondents Melanie Liska and Tarrington Liska. I think it's important in this case to keep clear and distinguish the claims of each appellant separately. So in a legal malpractice case, of course, each plaintiff needs to establish all of the elements.
And understood. Could we talk about the damage claim of the son and his spouse as opposed to the parents because they are situated very differently? How would damages be calculated? How would you calculate the value of the life estate in this case?
Sure. Well, and that's the point, and as far as we're concerned, is you can't calculate damages in this case because it's based upon speculation upon speculation upon speculation in terms of assuming that a lien is attached at some point that's not been filed, assuming that they don't sell the property before the lien, you know.
Let me walk you through a few questions. Do you agree about this golden life estate theory that if things had been left as they were, there was no possibility of a lien for medical assistance benefits?
No, we disagree with that.
And why is that?
Because under the pre-2003 law, there was a risk of a medical assistance lien attaching to the life estate during Helen's lifetime. The only thing the 2003 amendment did was say we're going to extend life estates. You know, typically under property law, they extinguish at the death, but we're going to extend them for the purpose of medical assistance to say that lien can continue beyond death. And so from Stephen and John's perspective, there was a benefit to removing the life estate in 2019 because they didn't want a lien to attach while Helen was still alive. That would affect their ability to, you know, do what they want with the property. So there absolutely was a risk of a lien at some point, even under the 1988.
Okay, so the difference is prior to the change, the lien could only attach during her life.
Correct.
But then after the change, it could attach. It didn't die with her.
Correct.
All right. That's so it's not as if it's like no possibility of a lien attaching under
correct.
The old law. That's your position. So then if that's the law and there was no possibility and there's no damages, do you agree then the statute of limitation isn't running on this claim? Because I do see a tension there. I mean, they're saying, one end you're saying, well, there are no damages. It's too speculative. But on the other hand, case law could suggest, well, no, you have some damage in theory, therefore the clock's running. It doesn't seem that you should have it both ways.
Well, I don't think there can be any damages until at least there's a lien filed. So I guess I disagree, and you know, counsel pointed to the Anton case. The statute of limitations didn't run when they paid the fees to the attorney. In that case, it ran when the marriage occurred, which was when there was damage from the antenuptial agreement. And so in this case...
And your position is there's no damage until there's a lien filed?
At least, because otherwise it's speculative. But then if there's no damage
until the lien is filed, then it would also stand to reason that the statute of limitations doesn't start to run until the lien is filed.
I mean, that's plaintiff's obligations to show damages. And so whether a subsequent case came and there was an allegation later on down the road that there was damages, that's something we could assess at that time. But, I mean, this case doesn't
have a
statute of limitations.
But would you be here arguing to us that, oh, no, they blew the statute of limitations. These cases say damage occurred when these transactions occurred, so they can't come back. That's what concerns me here. It seems like there is a tension here, and there needs to be a way to resolve it. And it might just be that the tension is, well, maybe there's enough damage to start the claim, but maybe they don't have enough non-speculative damage to go to a jury. That's what I'm trying to sort through in my mind.
I think that's true. Their burden is not only to show some damage, but that there's not speculative damage, right? And so that's a concern.
And do you agree that let's say if this were to go to trial and damages need to be determined by the jury, the way to do it would be to say, well, first of all, do you agree that is the amount of the lien for which MA can recover limited to the value of her life estate? In other words, you got to figure out what the value of the life estate is. You can't have any more than that.
Yes, and that's not just a difference of opinion between the experts. That's in the statute itself in subdivision 1I of 256B.15. It's built in the statute that
I thought I had read that someplace.
Exactly.
Aside from expert affidavits. So it's the value of the life estate, and what opposition is saying is, well, if we go to trial, we'd be able to calculate the value of the life estate based on predictions regarding how long mother is going to live, and then that would tell us what our damages are. Why is that not an acceptable way of determining damages?
Well, because we don't even know if there's ever going to be a lien. We don't know if the lien is ever going to have to be satisfied. And so these are still speculative problems, regardless of the calculation of what a lien might be.
Do you think there's any chance the government's not going to file a lien to recoup MA costs if a lien can be filed?
I think there's a possibility that the government has discretion to do that, and there might also be a window of opportunity for the property to be sold before a lien is attached. And so there's a lot of possibilities and assumptions baked into this.
If you know, that seems odd to me, because if it's like, well, we have this look-back period so people can't take the so people can't avoid having their assets used to fund their medical care. So we have this look-back period, but what you're saying is that they could sell the house, which avoids the lien, which avoids the whole look-back period.
And again, I think we need to separate Helen and Wayne from Stephen and John, because your questions before about the look-back period is that the lien, the look-back period only affects ineligibility for medical assistance.
Right.
So Helen and Wayne had a period of ineligibility. But that's Helen and Wayne's problem. That doesn't cause damage to Stephen and John. They were able to use the property without a risk of any lien after Liska's actions. And that's under 514.981 subdivision 1, that liens can only attach to property, quote, that is owned by the medical assistance recipient on or after the time when the recipient is institutionalized. After Liska's actions, when she was institutionalized, she had no ownership interest.
Of the look-back period, then?
It makes the medical assistance recipient ineligible for medical assistance for a period of time. That is the difference.
But then if the person becomes eligible and starts receiving the benefits, can't a lien attach so long as they had an ownership interest within the look-back period?
No. No, it can't. Under the statute that I just quoted, they have to have an ownership interest in the property at the time they are institutionalized.
But your point about eligibility, I assume that's why they had to rush out to redo the life estate. She just wouldn't qualify unless she either came up with a dollar value, essentially pay it on her own.
It's a spend down.
That might be why they did that. I don't know. That's not been a part of the record. But again, that's a choice that they had. Helen and Wayne could have chosen to pay for her medical care on their own. Instead, Stephen and John maybe gratuitously granted a life estate back to them, but they didn't have an obligation to do that. Stephen and John were not liable for Helen and Wayne's medical care. And so that's why it's important to separate the two sets of people.
Getting back your answer to Judge Larkin's question about whether there's a damage, wouldn't that be a proper fact question for a jury to decide based on the experts who then would opine and testify to that degree?
I don't think it's a fact question here because the statutes, when you actually get into them, are so clear that there was no damage to Stephen and John in particular, because there was no ownership interest by Helen at the time. So there couldn't have been a lien to Stephen and John. Helen and Wayne, if you get past the attorney-client relationship issue, their damages are still speculative for a number of reasons, because there's been no lien attached, because we don't know if the property is going to be sold, if the lien is ever going to have to be satisfied. And I think with all of those speculations upon speculations, it is the court's job to say this is too speculative for a jury to decide, because, of course, we don't allow juries to award damages based on speculation.
And for the benefit of the room, there is a Minnesota Supreme Court explaining that is for the court and not for the jury to determine what, in any case, is the proper rule of damages and when damages are speculative so that they should be excluded. So I think this is all an issue of law. And that's why it's sort of summary judgment is interesting, because we're saying, well, there's an argument on the other side that the court didn't view the facts in the light most favorable, referring to a lawyer's opinion of what these statutes say. And I don't view that as facts. These are legal issues. And whether damages are too speculative is a legal issue.
I agree. There can't be a dispute of fact about what the law says. That makes no sense.
Just to get back to your argument about the 2003, the way you explained it, Stephen and John actually have a malpractice claim, arguably against the attorney who now, the speculative damage, but the point being, you're saying that they had no risk before that subsequent reattachment of the life estate, whereas they now do, prospectively, presumably.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's why that action in the 2021 life estate back to Helen and Wayne is a superseding and intervening cause, because without that, there was no damage to Stephen and Wayne at all. They would never be liable for the lien. And that was their choice. That was completely unforeseeable in 2019 that would occur. I'll touch just briefly then on the attorney-client relationship issue with Helen and Wayne. There can't be a third-party beneficiary theory here, because there was no intent to benefit them. The entire purpose of the deeds in 2019 was to eliminate their interest in the property, which is the opposite of an intent to benefit. So it makes no sense to sort of extend the third-party beneficiary theory to cover facts such as this. And so Helen and Wayne, I think, that's the easiest way to sort of assess their claims. No attorney-client relationship, easy enough. And then Stephen and John, for all of the reasons that we've discussed, I think the easiest way for the court to look at it is simply just as I said, that there's no possibility of a lien for property that's not owned by the medical assistance recipient.
And that's 256B 51 subdivision 1B.
I'm looking at 514.981 subdivision 1A. It may be in multiple places, and some of these statutes are fairly repetitive.
And 514.981 sub 1A says no possibility of a lien if...
It says, I'll just quote it here. Subject to sections, whatever, payments made by a medical assistant agency to provide medical assistance benefits to a medical assistance recipient who owns property in this state or to a recipient's spouse constitute a lien in favor of the agency upon all real property that is owned by the medical assistance recipient on or after the time when the recipient is institutionalized. So she didn't have an ownership interest in the property at the time she was institutionalized. There can be no lien.
Okay, but that flies in the face with everything I know secondhand, firsthand, about the look-back period. Because what you're saying is, as long as you transfer your property before you go into the nursing home, it's free and clear of liens. And I just don't think that's how it works. I thought the whole purpose of the look-back period was, if you transfer your property within so many years of going in, they're going to take it.
So what the look-back period means is that if you transfer your property within so many years, you can't get medical assistance for X number of amount of time after you go into the nursing home. There are...
But then what? Okay, you say X amount of time. What if then you start getting it? Can they then go after the property?
No, then you qualify because you've satisfied your look-back time. You've satisfied your period of ineligibility.
So what you're saying is the look-back period is not about the ability to attach the lien, it's about your ability to access care at the government's expense.
Correct.
So you'll have to pay for some of your care, but then once you have depleted your assets, then you'll qualify for MA.
Correct. And there are certain circumstances in which there can be a cause of action against a third party, but that's never been an argument that's been made in this case, and it's speculative as to whether that would even be pursued by the state or whether it would be successful or so on and so forth.
Mr. Sortland tells us to look at 256B. You're telling us to look at 514, and you're saying that they're not in conflict.
So if you look at 256B subdivision 1IC, I mean, it says the same thing, that it's limited to the life estate that they had in the property. I don't think they are in conflict, no, and I see that my time has expired, but I think if you take a hard look at these statutes, and I know that they're dense, but they do support our position, so I would just ask that the court affirm in all respects. Thank you.
Mr. Sortland, could you explain to us your view of how these statutes work in terms of what the look-back period does? Not your expert, your view.
Well, I'm no expert, so I would defer to David Johnson, who provided the affidavit for us.
Well, that's not a brief to this court, so I'd like to hear from you as the attorney who's arguing the case. You know, how do you think these statutes work? Is it true that... all the look-back period does is prevent a person from receiving MA benefits for a period of time. It does not enable the government to go back and attach a lien for MA benefits for property for which there was no ownership interest at the time the benefits or at the time care was initiated.
Yeah, no, I think the whole purpose of the look-back period is to disallow or not encourage such transfers of property for less than full consideration, particularly to relatives, to keep them out of the grasp of the medical assistance subrogation statutes. I think the system would fall down if that were the case. And what Ms. Liska did here was to simply not take those into account at all, simply by transferring them out of the hands of Wayne and Helen Hukreid in 2019. And then she goes into the nursing home in, 2021, she's liable. And there's no way around that. That's the whole purpose of the statute. That's the whole purpose of the 60-month look-back period. You can't avoid it so easily like that. And so that's the way I see it.
Can you explain, I think, everyone in the room would agree that Steve and John had a attorney-client relationship with Ms. Liska. How do Wayne and Helen, in your view, have that same relationship?
They have a claim against Ms. Liska, whether it's attorney-clients or something else, because by providing these deeds to them, by preparing these deeds for their signature, which were brought to them by their son Stephen without any further explanation, they understood that Ms. Liska had prepared these deeds for them, and that's something that Stephen wanted. She's basically providing legal advice to Wayne and Helen Hucreed. She did this without seeing them face to face, without discussing it with them, without warning them that they should seek assistance from another attorney before entering into such a major transaction. And because of all those failures, she violated not only the Minnesota Rules of Professional Responsibility, but violated her duty of care to Helen and Wayne Hucreed, which I've outlined in my brief. So I think that's very important to note that they have a mechanism to pursue a claim against her, whether you consider them beneficiaries of the work done for their son and his husband, or simply by providing this legal assistance to the Hucreeds, to Wayne and Helen themselves, by virtue of providing them with this deed, there is liability there. So that's our position in that respect.
But the Ms. Liska's attorney says that you haven't cited any authority that a violation of the professional rules, Rule 4.3, specifically would create an attorney-client relationship for purposes of a legal malpractice claim.
That's the way the preamble writes. But the preamble also says that we recognize that these often form standards of care to which attorneys must abide. And according to my expert, this is one of those standards to which the attorneys must abide. You've got to watch out for somebody that you're providing a deed for. You've got to explain it to them. You've got to make sure that if you send their son to explain it to them that he does it right. If not, you're liable. You've got to suggest that they contact another attorney for advice. She didn't do that. And all of that, I think, makes her liable to the elderly Hucreeds, as well as Stephen and John Tripp, even though Stephen and John Tripp may suffer the majority of the losses here. So I think that's a very important point.
Can I ask a question? I mean, and I appreciate all the briefing and the arguments today, but to me it seems to come down to the question of do these actions by Attorney Liska expose the property to the possibility of a lien for MA care or not? And if the answer is yes, you would say, well, there are your damages, the claim accrues, we just need to measure the damages. But right. It seems to me that's the $20,000 question. Did those actions take the property from a place where it was protected from any lien from MA care and put it in a position where it was going to be subject to a lien?
Right. It's our position that the lien, you don't need to have a lien imposed to determine damages. The lien won't be imposed. The lien won't be filed until her death or within a year of her death. And the statutes, if you look at them, are mandatory. They use the word, the agency shall file the lien. And right now we know the lien is worth approximately, about $200,000. Probably a lot more by this time. It's been a while since the motion was heard. And we can figure out from that what the damages would be. Even if you cut the damages off right now, you've got damages of $200,000 plus the tax basis issue. We don't have to wait until that's all run its course. These are similar for any future damages. The jury has to make a reasonable approximation of what the damages are in order for them to be viable. We've got that here. We've presented everything. This matter should be remanded back to the district court, and we should have a jury trial.
And one more question.
Yes.
Why would the damages be greater than the value of her life estate? How can the lien, I mean, they can file a lien for a greater amount of a life estate, but how could the government take more from the property than the value of her life estate?
I think the government is entitled to the value of the way my expert explains it to me, the government is entitled to the value that she had in the house, which would be 50% of her life estate, or 50%.
Okay, and so what if that value is far less than the outstanding cost of MA?
If that's true, then they would get less.
Okay, that's what I want to make sure I agree, because it seems to me that, you know, if they can get compensation for the MA, it's limited to the value of the life estate. So you're throwing out numbers about 200,000, but we're talking about if the house is worth 500,000 and she has 50% of the value of the life estate, I'm having a hard time, you know, seeing how you're getting above that number. And I'm not looking at the math, but I could just imagine that it would be much less than $200,000 or whatever.
Well, I think it's $200,000, but it may not be much more if that happens, if we don't go up in price. Okay, thank you.
All right, the matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.